and Custody Working Group. So I just want to put that on the record and make that clear to everyone who's here. And so what I'd like to do before we go to an overview of our charge again to remind us what we're focused on in this group, I wanted to give the floor over to Chairman Boylan for any comments that he'd like to make. And again, thank you, Chairman, for coming today.
My pleasure. And it's not to be nosy or overbearing, and I will try not to be in all these groups, but I typically would attend most meetings where I can. So I'd like to be part of the conversations because in many respects, I sort of will be the glue as we pull the groups together. I know you're going to speak to the charge, but in many respects, I would characterize this working group as, and I really did appreciate what you said at the last committee meeting. You talked about how diverse the needs are with respect to housing and custody, because it's not all long-term and short-term, male, female, or juvenile. It is a broad array of kind of things, and I think that's going to be something that I'm hopeful that your committee is able to work its way through and then make a determination as to what is the appropriateness of housing for those various who are defendants who are in the detention or adjudication process. I think that's really, really important in the context of this, and probably critical as anything that we're and I don't say that about every committee. I'm saving this one just for yours because I appreciate the importance of that. And I know part of your work is being creative as it relates to that. So I look forward to your thoughtfulness and the work of your group. And with that, I want to say to the members of the group, thank you for your participation. I suspect there'll be others. As I came out of the other room, there were already 9-10 people sitting around the table talking about the various interests they have in that. And I hope to see the same situation happen here. But thank you, Chris, for Councilmember Miller, for your the opportunity to speak. And I will bounce in and out of these meetings, but I do want to sit in today and see how this one goes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I also wanted to say, based on recent exchanges and guidance that you've given, I've chosen to go with myself as the chair and then bring in subject matter experts to be able to work with us. And so we've chosen to have a couple of the subject matter experts sitting up here with me so that it's just a little bit easier as far as the exchanges and their input and you know, adding in thoughts. But mainly for efficiency purposes, I've chosen to just go ahead and have regular subject matter experts, if you will, rather than additional co-chairs added to our group.
As a follow-up to the email I said yesterday, you're certainly welcome to set it up any way you want. And the other groups are doing exactly the same thing. They're inviting the subject matter experts to be at the table, so when the conversations happen, they're not sitting in the back room waving their hands, saying, "Can I be part of the conversation?" So you're more than welcome to have as many up here as you are able to invite and host.
Again, thank you very much. And to move on to our agenda here, just an overall welcome again to everyone. And as far as reviewing the charge, I'll go back over that again. The guidance that we received from the chair, and that we've focused on refining, and our overall goal of this housing and custody working group is to take a comprehensive look at our existing facilities and practices, as well as the best ways to address our detention requirements going forward. And as the chair pointed out, there are various groups and subgroups that we're going to be focused on of detainees, in particular, and other related concerns. And so we're going to, in these first two sessions, being The one today, and we also, the next one is on October 13th at 8 a.m., also here in this Don Davis room. These first two sessions will be focused on where are we now? What is our assessment of where we are now? And then the third and fourth sessions, and then if any additional ones are needed, we'll add, but this is our base. The third and fourth sessions will be on November 3rd and December 1st, also at 8 a.m. in the Don Davis room right here. Again, these are subject to adjustments as needed, but we, at this point, we wanted to be able to get that schedule out there so everyone's well aware, the public who wanted to participate, like Bruce back here, and any others, would be able to plan for their schedule as well as the subject matter experts. What I'd like to do right now is, you know, it is such a small group, and I hope everyone's okay with that. If not, you don't have to introduce yourself. But I'd like to start with the folks up here. You've already heard from Chair Boylan, and the name tag is not correct for here, but you know, I wanted to bring in, and I think it's a great approach, is bringing in local, in our case, contractors who have worked in the confinement space and are experts at building the facilities that are needed, not only here in Jacksonville, but throughout Florida, Georgia, and other states as well. And so we've asked Perry McCall to provide people to assist us, subject matter experts to assist us in our endeavor here as a working group. So if you please introduce yourself. And if you get close to the mic, we want to make sure we record and everyone can hear properly.
I'm Dan Lee. I'm Director of Pre-Construction for Perry McCall Construction and Elkins Construction. And I've worked throughout the Southeast for many, many years, 25 years.
Thank you very much, Dan. And to my left is Assistant Division Chief Adrian O'Neill, and he will be a regular here. He's I don't know how much part of this was voluntold and how much was volunteer, but he's been so kind to say, you know, I want to be part of this. I want to be part of this working group and helping you get to the right recommendations for us short-term and long-term. So Assistant Division Chief O'Neill.
Yes, I'm Adrian O'Neill. I've been with the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office Department of Corrections for 28 years. Right now I'm over the custody and housing at the pretrial detention facility.
And so how appropriate is it that we're called the Housing and Custody Working Group, and how appropriate is it to have him as one of our subject matter experts to help us in our efforts? And then over here on the right, if you guys wouldn't mind, if you would come up to the microphone so we can hear you, but you don't have to. If you want to introduce yourself now, I know we have a representative from the courts and IT area of our court system that Chief Judge Day has been so kind to offer representative for each one of our meetings.
From here, okay?
Yeah, sure. Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. And Bruce, you want to introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Bruce Foraker. I'm a sales associate and consultant with Watson Commercial Realty.
Okay, thank you. And also from Northeast Florida Regional Council.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Annie Seeger. I'm from Northeast Florida Council.
Thank you, Ms. Seeger. Okay, you know, and I had said we were going to, well, you know, I'm going to stop right here because I do want to, And I'm new at all the rules, and I want to make sure we're following all the rules. And so at this time, I'd like to ask for counsel overview of those rules. If we could have them at this time, that would be helpful, because these are good reminders. And for others, maybe it's the first time, but we want to make sure we're working efficiently, effectively, but we're also doing it properly.
Yes. Thank you. Carl, I think I broke the microphone. Sorry, Jeff. Carla Lopera, Office of General Counsel. Thank you. So good news for you all. Your chair, Council Member Miller, has decided to hold this more like a working group. So that means Sunshine Law, which are the laws that promote transparency in government and are very important, will not apply. You all can talk to each other. You can talk to the chair about items that have to do with this working group. I will say that my recommendation to you is to retain all your records. Because you are acting in an advisory capacity as subject matter experts in this group, I would ask that, pursuant to public records law, that you retain any text messages, emails, anything created as part of the business done here. And with that, if you have any questions about Sunshine Law, public records, I am happy to answer those.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I did go a little bit out of order regarding the agenda that was sent out, but at this point, I would like to, if we could, go to Assistant Division Chief O'Neill, and he's going to cover some, you know, give an overview of some of the things that give us a good indicator of the different types of groups as JSO currently works with and actually separates them out for detention and other purposes, and also go over some of the things how the detainees are currently being and housed and maintained, and some of those challenges associated with that. And again, with the focus being on how things currently are in our area of focus. So Adrian, if you wouldn't mind sharing what you think is appropriate in that realm.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to share, starting off, when the jail was built in 1991, we were our capacity was set at 2189. Currently today, at the pretrial detention facility, we are at 2625. That's sentenced and unsentenced, male and female. We have a total of 42 male juveniles and one female juvenile. We have 7 housing floors, and the dynamic of the facility has changed over the years with the growth of the inmate populations. For our lower level housing, I'm going to go by each of the housing and try to give a brief description of the classifications. The lower level housing is where we have our county sentence inmate workers. We used to have 3 dorms with the working inmates. Now we're down to 2. We have 2 dorms that are working and 1 that's sentenced inmates that are non-working. Those non-working inmates, they used to be housed on a different floor, but with the rise in the numbers, we have to mitigate those areas and, you know, end up putting them in another area. On the first floor housing, we have, that's our overflow housing. One of the dorms, we comprise of a medical dorm. Earlier when the building was first built, our second floor, we would have approximately 12 cells that were made with hospital beds in it. But we had to renovate those cells and add other bunks to those cells to create more space. So now we have 1 dorm on the first floor for the medical inmates, those inmates that have CPAPs and any other medical issues that need attention. The second floor of the facility is our nonviolent and misdemeanors. And we have 16 smaller dorms on those floors, which, they have 12 cells in them, and each cell has 3 bunks. We have 2 cells on each end that has ADA, so those cells have two bunks in them. With that capacity, like I said, most of the misdemeanors, the people that's coming in and out on non-serious charges are housed on the second floor.
Assistant Chief, question with respect to how long are they, given a sample, as to how long is someone detained within the second floor?
On the second floor, they can come in and one day and they can be gone the next day. If they're able to bond out after first appearance, if they don't bond out after first appearance and they are given a bond, they can be there up until their arraignment day, which is 2 to 3 weeks from that day.
So anywhere from one day to one overnight stay to multiple
3
weeks.
Yes.
Got it.
Or the misdemeanors. Then if they get sentenced or the date gets passed after the arraignment, then they can continue on until their case is completed. On our third floor, is currently housing all of our female population. On the third floor, previously, I've been there since 1995, and we used to have only one side of the facility for female inmates. But the growth from 1995 to now, we have an entire floor, inmates on the east side of the building and inmates on the west side of the building. So that they've taken over a complete floor due to the increased population of the females. The fourth floor, we have the state sentence inmates, some of the state sentence inmates that are getting ready to go to prison. We have some of the state sentence inmates that have come back for appeals, and we have some state sentence inmates throughout the facility that are sentenced to state time and they still have additional charges to complete, and they are housed on that floor as well.
And roughly how long? That could be a very extended stay, if my memory serves me correctly.
Yes, with the state sentence inmates, when they're there for their pretrial, time before their trial, all the way through their time, we've seen inmates stay up to 5, 6, 7 years to complete their trials. Just recently, we had one inmate that was there for 11 years, still going. Sometimes these inmates have to leave, go out to the state hospital for mental evaluations. They come back, and then they may end up having to go back several times for competency hearings.
But are these those extended stays to that degree? Those are the exceptions, right? And you have any feel for the numbers of those that are, say more than 2 years?
Well, at the next meeting, I can provide the numbers of the ones that have extended times that are not state sentenced. Most of the time when they are state sentenced, they are not going to be housed there that long. But going up into the trial, for more of the serious crimes, the ones that have waived their speedy trials, they will be in the facility for extended periods of time.
I think that's an important part to mention, where they have chosen and their lawyer and they have chosen to waive that speedy trial right, then that ends up adding to the numbers that you've been describing. Okay.
So on that floor also, we'll have 4 big dorms. In the big dorms, we have 24 cells in each one of those dorms, and that can be 72 inmates can be in one housing area. In 2007, we used to have the more portable bed units that the inmates would sleep on when we were overcrowded. So we tried to mitigate that by adding a third bunk to the cells to keep the inmates from having to sleep on the portable bedding units. So those numbers used to be 48 to the big cells and 24 to the smaller cells. Now we're at 36 in the smaller cells and 72 in the bigger dorms. And still to this day, we're still using the portable bedding units past those numbers. Like on the second floor, we are at, I think we had like 50, hold on 1 second. Portable bedding units. We had like 64 on the second floor. And with the females on the third floor, we have about 24 that was on the portable bedding units.
What further complications, challenges does that create, you know, when you have so many on those? And I've seen them when we toured. It's like a little sled, a curved sled that they actually sleep, you know, that's put directly on the floor. One of them I saw, one of those units, and correct me if I'm wrong here, they said it doesn't allow for, you know, lockdown in the evening and the privacy that normally would be afforded to those separate areas. When you get that overcrowded, it creates a situation where they pretty much stay open day and night, and so the privacy and the other factors like hygiene, and you have to make other arrangements for those people who are on the sleds to be able to use some of the cell areas that you leave open. If you could speak to that, that would be good.
Once we have to move to the portable bedding units, per the Florida Model Jail standards, those portable bedding units, the inmate has to be 12 inches off the floor, so they have to sleep on top of the bunk. When they are sleeping on those portable bedding units, they are out in the day room. They are not confined to a cell, and it's harder to control the areas when we have them sleeping in an open area and not in a enclosed area. So we have incidents happening. We would have to put the inmate, those inmates would have to stay on their bunk, but they're in an open area, so they can't be secure. And that's one of the big challenges that we have when the numbers are higher in those classifications. The classification that we try to keep together, the misdemeanors have to be with misdemeanors or nonviolent felons. They can't be housed with the violent felons. In some instances, the nonviolent felons can be housed with the violent felons. But the violent felons, we have an area on the fifth floor. All dorms on both sides of the fifth floor house our violent felon inmates. And fourth floor, four west, on the west side of the fourth floor. But those are the different classifications that we have. And then when we get to the sixth floor, we have our confinement areas. In two of the dorms, we have our juvenile population. Like I said, we have 42. One dorm is for the confinement juveniles. The next is the open population of juveniles. The rest of those dorms on that floor, we house the confinement, the mental health inmates, disciplinary confinement inmates, administrative confinement inmates, and the self-harm precaution inmates. The ideal thing for the mental health inmates, they are to be housed separately. But once we have a certain amount of numbers, we have to consolidate the ones that can be housed with another, that can be compatible with another. We have to group them together because we don't have the space to for them to have their own cells. Even with the self-harm inmates, the same situation takes place. Out of the MCC, like...
Would you mind, I know it's an acronym, but we're used to, but if you would spell that out for everyone, that'd be helpful.
It's the Montgomery Correctional Facility out at Laney Road.
And what do some people refer to that to?
As the pea farm.
Pea farm. So those terms are synonymous, you know, going forward, if anyone's wondering what he's referencing there.
Before you go there, also, we should probably mention, since you mentioned juvenile felony, juveniles in the main facility, there's also a separate facility for those juveniles who have not been deemed to be charged with an adult crime, correct?
Yes, the juveniles that we house, they are all adjudicated as adults, and we are one of the only ones in this area. I think St. John's County has just renovated their facility to house their juveniles, but we house Nassau, Clay, and Flagler at times. We house their juveniles. And the jail downtown is the pretrial detention facility where all of the pretrial unsentenced inmates are supposed to be housed. But since the numbers are up, like I said, with Jacksonville growing, the bed that, you know, the capacity at the jail has not grown for the influx of people that's moving to Jacksonville. Like today at MCC, we have 444 inmates that are unsentenced because we cannot house them at the pretrial detention facility due to space. Over at CTC, which is the Transition Center, Community Transition Center.
And where is that located?
That's on Catherine Street, Catherine and Church.
8th, yeah, right.
Or 21 Catherine Street.
Well, may I ask a question? Interesting, you've got folks on the fourth floor who've been there multiple years. Why are they not transferred out to the pea farm so that those who are waiting for trial can come back in?
Inmates out at the pretrial detention facility, we are a maximum security facility. MCC was originally set up as a work facility. That's a work camp for work county sentenced inmates up to a year. And the state sentenced inmates, anyone that's sentenced one day over a year on through life or death. So we can't have, and that's like a medium security facility.
You know, I did want to go on a little side conversation related to what you just said. You mentioned work details, but there's always a ripple effect of the numbers going up, and you've heard him comment on some of those things, but there's always a ripple effect on other things that are done and their ability to do these other things, and one of them is the work details. Could you speak to that on how that used to be based on the type of individual that was detained out there? And I'm referring to sentenced versus unsentenced mainly. Could you speak to the impact that has had on the ability to do the other things throughout our city regarding work details?
Yes, previously the MCC, Montgomery Correction Center, was set up for our work camps, our programs, with trades and things like that. They would go out to throughout the city, each zone, each district now, to help with cleanups, any kind of work that was requested throughout the city. We had the whole facility was a working facility. Prime example, we have two of the buildings out there is 8 dorms. 8 of those dorms used to be all sentenced inmates. All of those inmates were sentenced to county time, hard labor. Currently, out of those 7 dorms, we only have 1 dorm that's sentenced. All 7 dorms are unsentenced inmates. Those unsentenced inmates are supposed to be housed at pretrial detention facility, but they are now, since our capacity is over capacity, we have to mitigate that by moving them out to MCC. And also at CTC, the Transition Center, they were set up for the Matrix program, work furlough.
Would you, since you mentioned it, and again, I think it's important on the front end, our first meeting, when we refer to something to be able to just give a brief description. What is Matrix, since you mentioned that?
Matrix program is our drug rehab program. That's most of them are county sentenced, court sentenced into the Matrix program. Some are volunteer when they're having substance abuse issues that they are wanting to get off of the drugs. We have a Matrix program, and they will be in that program, I think it's like 4 months. And then once they graduate that, some of them have termination of sentence upon completion of that program. That's the Matrix program.
And it's to help them with transition, to be able to make, you know, as good of a transition as possible.
Right. Getting them off of drugs and being going back into society to be productive citizens, drug-free. And the other program that we used to have was the work furlough. And right now that's not in effect as of the pandemic. We do no longer have the work furlough inmates.
And is that primarily also due, like the work, the work program, is that primarily due to the overcrowding, the impact of that, or is it, like you said, there was a change made due to COVID period?
During the pandemic, we end up having to discontinue the work furlough program and move some unsentenced inmates over to that facility. Like currently, right now, we have 86 male unsentenced inmates in that facility, which are supposed to be housed at a pretrial detention facility. So we don't have any space for the work furlough program at this time.
Okay. Thank you for that.
So basically over the time, like I said, since I've been there since 1995, we've seen the influx of inmates. Our capacity was at 2189. Now we're constantly reaching 2600, 2700 in the downtown facility, but we have to send other unsentenced inmates to the other two facilities just for housing, because we don't have the space.
Councilmember Miller, I suggest that Assistant Chief meet with Annie at some point in time after this meeting so that we can accurately capture that population breakdown that you've given us.
Sure.
And the capacity for those, because it's a lot of great information there. To your point, we need to have a very clear understanding of how that population breakout is, and we'll get that for all of us in this process. Also, in the context of that conversation, you mentioned quite vividly about the impact of, in terms of in female detention going on and how it's grown. As we take a look at this facility, obviously, if you build it, they will come. I'm not encouraging that, but at the same time, recognizing that we are will be building a facility at some point in time that either needs to be expandable or be able to address future needs as well as existing needs. So that's going to be part of our challenge, and maybe the composition of the facility that may be better served in a different capacity, a campus-style housing facility, for example, that you can add another unit down the road if necessary and that kind of thing. Because I think growth is going to be a factor as it relates to Jacksonville. Coming out of South Florida and watching the tremendous growth down there, you'll see that's happening here too. So that needs to be a major component to our conversation and consideration.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, you had a comment you wanted to make? Or do you, is that... Okay. Yeah. Go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. If you would come up to the mic, that would be helpful. Thanks, Bruce.
Bruce Fouracre. My information's on file, and I had a question regarding the second floor at the jail. On the female population, what percentage of them are maximum security?
The maximum
number.
I can give you that number. The females. Our female, we have 68 violent felons.
Mm-hmm.
We have another 68 that's nonviolent and violent felons that are housed together. We have 15 that's currently state sentenced, and those are the ones that are the maximum security.
A lot fewer than the male maximum security.
Yes. Okay. Right now I have a total of 484 females total on that one
floor. Because obviously one of the considerations going forward is to do something specifically to house maximum security separate. Thank you.
You know, and as I mentioned earlier that, and it may have been in our general committee meeting, I'm trying to remember, but Assistant Chief O'Neill also heads up a JSO housing classification effort where they've been looking at this internally with JSO, and they have various categories, just like we have working groups of our committee, and they already have a number of very good recommendations for changes of facilities and help with design of a future facility and what that looks like. And they've broken it down into different lists based on, you know, what would be supportable, I'm sure financially and as far as the footprint and other things like that. I wanted to ask, you know, there are a few of this one recommendation listing from the housing and classification area. Are you comfortable? Are you okay with me sharing a few of these recommendations? I just wanted to give, we'll capture all of them and incorporate them into what we record and what we share. But I just wanted to list a few of these recommendations for going forward that speak to some of the things he mentioned that were facts of where we are right now, but also look beyond and what we really need facility-wise, and also what we have, the numbers, other things that we have that we try to limit ourselves to for obvious reasons. And I'm just going to mention a few of those. One of the recommendations was no dorms larger than 12 cells, housing 24 to 36 inmates, you know, and that's based on the desire to, you know, give them more space, but to also be able to manage or provide oversight from a staffing perspective. Also, the recommendation was for having a separate building for juveniles, the male and female. The numbers support it, didn't originally support that. I'm sure when that structure was built, I think roughly 32 years ago, but we're definitely there, and the projection is to be increasing, so we would definitely want to factor that into a new facility plan. I also suggested interview rooms for inmates to visit with attorney via video, and for the detectives as well. We're going to hear in a little bit some comments about the IT video perspective of being able to process inmates through the court system and how important that is.
Just I think largely should be taken up in the intake working group.
Right.
I appreciate the fact that it's part of this conversation here.
Right.
But, you know, in terms of housing, that really belongs probably in that process group over there. So make sure whatever we get capture here, we share with them as well.
We certainly will. And you know, there is a lot of overlap in what we're going to do, and I see that as a good thing.
Oh, yeah.
Because we're making sure we're covering all aspects of this. And I think that's a good point also.
I spent almost 20 minutes talking housing next door. So I said to them, we need to make sure that information gets across the hall.
Right. That's great. Thank you, Chair. Another one is new arrival housing area to house inmates until arraignment, both male and female. Do you want to comment any further on that?
Did have a suggestion on that, like wherever the main facility is, I'm sure it's not going to be in the downtown area, but if we had a processing area that when we bring the inmates in, because some of them will be bonding out, some of them will get time served right at court, or in, if not, we can have them at a facility close by. Recommendation was, I was thinking about our CTC facility, since it's already here, and the programs that they have there could be at the new facility. And just, you know, minor renovations would be, and that would be cost-effective for that. But that was one of the ideas going into that process.
Okay, thank you. And I think that's also something for all of us to keep in mind. I think when people think the jail or related jail matters, most people think one structure, one location. It's not that way now, and it certainly won't be that way in the future. In fact, I think we'll have more of a need for multiple structures in various locations associated with the court and the courthouse and the court system, but to try to make things more efficient for the process, to move things quicker and reduce the numbers that we've heard talked about here earlier. Another suggestion was for an enclosed area for officer and direct supervision dorms. This definitely is a structure issue, and I remember as we went through this latest tour recently, you know, it's not set up properly to be able to provide the correct oversight, and you know, there is definite work to be done here, so that for the good of the inmates, for safety, other reasons for staff and safety of the inmates, that there's definitely a need for that adjustment in the structure in each one of those dorms. An area for video court, first appearance, pretrial hearings, civil hearings. We're in an era now where we found not only, you know, in other ways, because of going through the COVID period, where virtual meetings sometimes, you know, do meet the needs and the requirements of whatever that action is that's going on. And in some cases in the medical community, we're now finding out we can do those things that we, I think, before didn't really understand that could be done in that way. And so now we're finding out, and they are already utilizing video court, and I think more so for first appearance, I believe, is where it's mostly being done, and where you have mostly one judge working all of those cases for first appearance, whereas on pretrial hearings, you have multiple judges working at the same time, and so that makes it a little more complicated to be able to do that, but I still think we need to maximize technology as we go forward, and maybe in making adjustments right now, maybe there are ones, and I think we'll hear about that in a little bit, but definitely going forward.
This is where my role as the glue coming here, because that was a big part of the conversation in the intake, was the first J1. I mean, that's what they're taking a look
at,
and there was an extended conversation. Pros and cons as related to in-person first appearance as opposed to a Zoom first appearance, and I think there are pluses and minuses there. One of the interesting things that Judge Kite brought up was the fact that it tends to, because we are in a paper process largely, there are significant delays, even in the first appearance process because of that. And so you're right. I think as we talk about technology here, I think that's part of the consideration. I know for myself, when I went through the Sallyport and the tour of the courthouse, recognized that Judge Moran was actually hosting a meeting with his staff in advance of first appearance to go over those things. If we packed up all those folks and decided to have to move them back to the court, to the jail for, you know, J1, now we have to have a space for them to have those pre-meetings, if you will, before first appearance starts. So those are the kind of things that they're focusing on, but it certainly is relevant to your point as well.
Yeah, and so to that end, it's probably good for me to just touch on and move on and get back to our agenda here and stay focused on the the housing and custody aspects. Just briefly, two more. I mean, like I said, there are a lot more here, but I just wanted to give a flavor of the recommendations they've already come up with that I think, help us going forward. One was building for the mental health inmates with step-down protocol in place. As you've heard, there's, because of overcrowding, there's already a mixing as best they can rather than a dedicated area only for those mental health inmates. But that step-down protocol, I think, is an important aspect going forward as well. And then the last one I just wanted to mention was the use of the current, and he's referred to this earlier, but the use of the current CTC facility as an intake and first appearance temporary housing facility. So we did talk about that. So I just wanted to hit some highlights there on some recommendations they've already come up with in his work within JSO that I think are helpful for our efforts as well. Unless someone has something else, or ADC O'Neill, do you have anything else at this time along the lines of groupings, where we are right now? I know we're going to follow on with some of these discussions to make sure we've captured this and we can share these current statistics with the other working groups as well. But was there anything else that you wanted to mention at this time?
No, I think that's covers about everything for right now. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. At this time, what I'd like to do is shift, and I know it's a very specific item, but I think there's some value in here of talking about that and how that impacts the numbers of detainees that we have and the efficiency of the overall process moving into the court system, and how that affects the numbers of detainees that we're working with. So at this time, if Mr. Smith would like to come to the microphone and share with us a little bit, we would appreciate that.
I'm Mike Smith. I'm the court technology officer for the Fourth Judicial Circuit, which includes Clay, Duval, and Nassau. And I'm here, I've had some meetings with Chief Judge Day, and he asked me to attend this meeting and talk about the technology that's currently in place, and kind of like also lay out where we're not too good at right now because of, all of the years that we've all kind of been doing our own thing. We're trying to pull things together. So you mentioned a lot about the video teleconferencing being used, and, post-COVID, we have that's incrementally gone, to every courtroom where we can use it. First appearance is easy because it's one courtroom over at the jail. Everybody's, all the inmates are pulled into one room, and there's one judge, like you mentioned, Councilman. And that works great. And all the other courtrooms where we have all the other inmates come in every day for a 5, 10, or 15-minute hearing in front of the judge to get ready for a trial, that's a little more difficult. If we were trying to put all of them on video, and we all know that sometimes, you get hiccups with the video, or sometimes there may be an issue with JSO trying to get all these inmates together and get them in front of one of those interview rooms, then that's just going to slow court down to a crawl. So that's not helping anybody move the process along of getting these folks, through the process and out of the jail. So that was one of the things I wanted to mention, that we are taking advantage of video teleconferencing where we can. In non-criminal cases, such as hearings for civil or family, it works great because that's a whole different process. But with the jail population, it's a little bit more difficult. We did take advantage. We did try to do this during COVID, but you have to remember back then it was all we could do, and it was a little clunky. We worked through it, and it took a lot of scheduling on JSO's behalf. So they had to totally kind of change the way they were doing things, and I can't speak to everything about that. I was just involved in some of the meetings, and I'm sure AC O'Neill can better update you all on that kind of stuff. But one of the other things, though, that would help us is I mentioned that we all have different programs. The court has a case management type system, the clerk, who's the official record keeper of all of these documents that come to the court, whether it comes from JSO or the state attorney or the defense attorney or batter's intervention or anybody, any other stakeholder with the court, all of those are all different systems. And unfortunately, because they were all done in a vacuum over the years, they don't all talk together like they should. And I just wanted to try to emphasize that moving forward, especially if there's going to be a different facility location, that we kind of tighten that up a little bit, because we don't want to, you know, get to a point where we may not be transporting everybody as much as we were, but we're going to be transporting paper, and that really doesn't make sense. A good example is probation orders, or you know, we recently are trying to get the writ recalls done, and we're working with JSO. We've been working with them for the last 3 or 4 weeks, and we have a pilot going. But that whole situation could be a lot better if, you know, we all kind of sat down at the table and got our systems talking a little bit better to each other.
Go ahead, please.
I love this part of the conversation. I know we had this conversation. I strongly encourage you to get involved in the intake and adjudication committee or working group, because that's where the rubber's going to meet the road as it relates to this. Yeah, I mean, when Judge Coker walked us through that whole process from being arrested and the police officer in his car putting information in, that information doesn't speak to the clerk of courts, doesn't speak to the criminal justice system. Are there systems out there that have already created this integrated process so that as soon as that police officer puts someone into his system, it flows seamlessly through the others? Is that possible to do, or are there systems out there that presently do that? I would imagine there
it's possible, Councilman, and I think there are some other jurisdictions that do it a little bit better than we do. None of them are perfect,
right?
Because, you know, in my humble opinion, if it was all one big system we all shared, it would be the best thing, but that's not going to happen. But
our dreams only, right?
Not while I'm CTO, probably. Right. Anyway, so to answer the other part of your question, we can bridge, though, these different systems, you know, with some consideration and of course, funding to each individual to get what they need. One of the things, and here's a perfect example, the clerk system doesn't recognize JSO's offender number or JSO's ID number. I think it's ID number now. And that would help us to, you know, make connections with some of the paperwork that's flowing through everybody's system. We mainly get most of our information, of course, from the clerk, because they're a managerial arm of the court, and they are the official record keeper. Even JSO has to go to the clerk to get some of the information post-trial or post-hearing. So, you know, that's why this is kind of important. But I don't want to leave the clerk out. The clerk of court is where the information mostly flows into, and they would probably be better to speak on what they need, but all of it kind of needs to come together, and that's what Chief Judge Day wanted me to speak about, was, you know, the kind of 10,000-foot view, and
right.
That needs to be part of this discussion, in my opinion. We can do all the video teleconferencing we want, but if that paper's going to be, if we're still in paper format with everything, and that goes also speaking to getting digital signatures on documents, even for the inmate. You know, if we leave that part of it out where they can't, you know, you sign on a pen pad or whatever for a plea or whatever, then they're never going to be able to get away from the paper. We're going to have to, everything else will be digital. We'll print it, let them sign it, and then we got to scan it back in to get it digital again, because that's the only way we save these documents.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. Appreciate it. I did want to come back to ADC O'Neill on a related matter as it pertains to housing and custody. If you would, from a JSO perspective, talk a little bit about the challenges associated with, especially when we're talking about pretrial appearances. I know it's no small task when you have to bring all of those detainees together to be able to then round them up and transport them to another location. And, you know, as it ties in with technology or technology possibilities, and realizing that the court, you know, they have requirements, and we need to be mindful of that. It's just not a matter of what works best for JSO. But if you would, please speak to some of those challenges of transporting that number of inmates, and then the frequency of that. And if you give us a little more feel for that, that would be appreciated.
Okay. All right. Courts are open Monday through Friday. Each morning around 4:30 in the morning, we get the inmates up that's going to court. They all have to be restrained, put into a staging area, and then transported to the courthouse. A lot of these inmates are pretrial, having pretrial hearings, and a lot of these, when we have like 300 inmates going to court, we bring 300 people to the courthouse, and the majority of those inmates are not going in front of a judge. They are still in the holding cells, or they get a new court date without even going into the courtroom, and then they go back to the courthouse. So it's a lot of movement, of moving inmates in and out of the facility that, you know, probably could be done in a different way. I know some have to be seen, you know, different times, by certain time frames, but when they're going to the courthouse and not being seen, it's just, you know, getting them up, restraining them, transporting them to the courthouse, not seeing a judge or not getting anything done, just getting a new court date and bringing them back. There's a lot of movement that we want to try to mitigate as much as possible, you know, with the unnecessary movements.
On average, recently, what are the numbers? Did you said around 300. Is that what you're currently experiencing?
I can say on the heavy days, our heavy days are mostly Tuesdays and Thursdays. And we have 200 to 300 inmates between the three facilities that we're transporting to the courts.
Yeah, I think that's also important to remember. It's not just right here going across town. It's also from quite a ways away and on Lanny Road, bringing those inmates that normally wouldn't be coming here, but because of the overcrowding situation we find ourselves in, there is a large number coming from that facility as well.
Like I mentioned before, today we had 444 unsentenced inmates out at MCC that still having to come back to court. And right before I was leaving, I knew it was a minimum of 40 that was moving out there. So that's going to add to that number. Those are the challenges with going to court. Now, the ones that's having hearings, court hearings, jury trials, and we love for them to, you know, be seen in court because we know they're getting close to being moved out of our system on to the next step. But the ones that are just going and not even making out of the holding cell, that's the challenge that we're having. We're restraining, getting them over, transporting them to and from, and they're not being seen. They're getting the court dates while they're in the holding cell and back to the facility.
One.
A couple other things that we need to talk about as part of this conversation. Obviously, housing and custody also includes food preparation. So we need to have to understand what are the needs with respect to kitchen, to food storage, a loading dock area. And then you think about the support services for housing and custody, which right. is parking for all the 200-plus officers and civilians who perhaps work in that facility, give or take, right. on that number. So, you know, HVAC systems, security systems, how do we manage that and those kind of things? So I'd not lose sight of those as we have the considerations of housing and custody. Those are integral to all of that. Even, you know, generator, and you know, I understand we got fuel storage issues right now, a leak in the fuel storage tank that we've got there and that sort of thing. Dan, I don't know, you're sitting here feverishly writing down notes. This is probably not unfamiliar to you, any of these concerns. I'm sure you hear them time and time again from other communities.
I hear mostly about the construction.
Uh-huh.
And the how you manage all the different types of inmates and how you do the bringing them into the system and how you handle that. This is interesting to me, but I've not been involved at this level where you start the planning of the facility, how everything integrates. I found a great source of information, 360 pages. I'm on page 180 right now, that tells me all about this planning, and it's a wonderful document that, if you don't mind, I'll share with you and you can distribute. But it goes through exactly what we're going through, how you separate female juveniles, violent, nonviolent, and how you manage the intake and take care of their clothing and secure all that. So all that information I will be glad to share. When it comes to construction, like the HVAC systems and the generators and all that, I'm there. I have current information. We'll be able to share a lot of information relating to that.
It's probably appropriate for me to share. You know, initially as we started this process, we were looking sort of a needs assessment, and we were looking for a consultant to do that work for us. We're doing that now, as you can hear, we're doing that now, and that's exactly what we're focusing on. So, and you're absolutely right. So hopefully at the end of the day, we're going to make your job much easier because we'll have a determination as to what our needs are and what we anticipate our future needs will be as it relates to all the services around custody and housing. So traditionally, you know, that's work that is probably part of the traditional RFP process. I suspect you're asked to do both at the same time. Mm-hmm. Make an assessment for us and then tell us what you want to build for us. Right. Whereas I think what we are trying to do through community conversations is to have a sense of what our needs are and make those determinations for ourselves and hand that off to folks like yourselves who then make a presentation as to, you know, what kind of facility or facilities do we need to build.
Right. There are many ways to build it, but
right.
The important part is what you're doing right now is the pre-planning, understanding the need, and making sure you get it right before it goes to paper, before it gets built.
Right. I hate to monopolize your conversation.
Yeah, no, that's...
But those are really important points to appreciate with respect to other aspects of custody and housing are the support services and the needs for those as well.
And I think you've obviously, well, and you've... As Chairman Boylan talked about, you've taken a lot of notes here, but I think inherent in the stats on where we are and again, the overcrowding situation, meaning the current structure is not sufficient for our needs right now. And so it requires so many adjustments in how you house and provide custody of all those inmates and meet the state requirements and other requirements that are there to best take care of not only the inmates, but also look out for our staff as well. But at a basic level, you know, I know this is partially getting into some other areas here, but would you mind commenting it in, you know, our current structure, obviously, has been talked about, it's vertical.
Right.
So we have... multiple layers. What is it? Is it six?
We have seven housing floors.
Seven housing.
But it's a okay. 16-story building, though, isn't it?
Yes, it's double floors. Each floor is a double level.
But as far as the housing of the inmates, you know, that's seven with a I guess almost twice that number of floors. That concept at one time in the building community. May have made some sense and must have because that's what they chose at the time, I guess, to save footprint. But what are you seeing now with current construction of these facilities?
Well, the current construction would be lower and more spread out. And like you said, different wings or different buildings even to separate the different aspects or different type of inmates. So that would be the current. But you really can't decide that until we go through the process of selecting a site. The site may dictate you go vertical, or it may allow us to go horizontal and spread out. So it's almost like a chicken or egg. You really can't determine what you build until you know where you're going to build it and you understand all of the requirements.
Right. Well, and don't go too far into details for, you know, what we're going to focus more on in meetings 3 and 4. But my, just by what we've seen and heard so far, you know, my personal hope is that we have the ability going forward to get the facility, the type of facility that we need, and that we have the space, the land, city land that we need to be able to hopefully never be in a situation like we are right now, that we find ourselves in right now. And that would entail a more horizontal series of structures, not just one structure, to be able to take the best possible care we can of the inmates that we have and make it the best manageable possibility for staff. And given we are experiencing shortages, current staffing shortages, and so that compounds that problem if you don't have the proper facility to house and provide housing and custody as you would like. So, yeah, I don't want to go too far down that road, but I thank you for your initial thoughts on that.
And the method of surveillance or the method of observing or securing the folks, you can go all the way from always having someone, a person watching, or you can go all the way to the extreme of having video surveillance. All of those dictate a lot of things we'll be doing here too, and the space required. So, and one has preference over the other, perhaps to some. So all of those things will there's a lot to be decided.
Okay.
And if
well, that's why we're doing this.
yeah. If Mr. O'Neill has all the information that he has in his head and on his papers there in a format that me as an outsider just joining in could have so that I could understand the requirements better, I would appreciate that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I think Annie's willing to, she's being voluntold to help us, help you in getting that into a form that we all can take advantage of.
That's great. That's great. And that's exactly why, and again, I applaud President Salem as well as Chair Boylan for bringing all these partners in this effort together, because I really, and again, bigger picture, I hope we use this model of approaching big issues for our city and city council more often, to be more strategic, looking at the bigger picture. So I really appreciate that forward thinking, and thank everyone for their role in that. I think for now, and we'll focus on more aspects of some of the things that have already been brought up at the next meeting, again, to continue on the conversation of assessing where we are right now. Where are we right now? So that we can then in the last two meetings focus on, okay, knowing where we are right now, where do we want to be? Where should we be? What should we be looking at regarding housing and custody aspects of designing, helping design the right facility so we have the flex when we have a shortage of staffing, or that we have a surge of inmates, or we have a COVID, you know, what are ways we can make sure those are factored into the future facility design and construction that hopefully puts us in a much better place than we're in right now. So I think what I'd like to do right now, unless we have, do we have any other comments from the people here? We're going to have public public speaking time for many of the cards that we may have. If we don't have any other comments from the individuals here. Okay. Yeah, if we would, how many cards, Carol, do we have?
Bruce.
Okay. Okay, but you've already spoken to that particular issue that was on your card? Okay, if you come forward, please.
Chris, this is
Chairman, if you don't have any objections, I'd like to real quickly ask one question of Chief O'Neill and one of Mr. Lee.
Okay, sure, please.
So, Chief O'Neill, with the courthouse holding cell facilities, are there any prisoner showers at all within the courthouse?
Prisoner showers?
Showers.
No, sir.
No, sir. Not okay, very good. I was just curious about that. You have a state-of-the-art sally port because my friend, the architect who designed the courthouse, has gone over some of the stuff with me on that. I had a question for you, Mr. Lee. If for some reason the city doesn't find enough land to go horizontal and ends up going vertical, how effective are the vacuum plumbing systems in preventing the problems we have at the current jail with the flooding? Okay, I'm sorry. If for some reason the city cannot find the land to go horizontal with the pretrial facility within the downtown area, you know, preferably connected to the courthouse, if they have to go vertical, how effective are vacuum-based plumbing systems at preventing the current flooding issues we have?
I'm unfamiliar with vacuum-based plumbing systems.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. The last thing I'd like to do is, since our chairman is still here, Chairman Boylan, if you wouldn't mind, if you would share, since you were so gracious to sit through our whole session today, if you wouldn't mind sharing some things you'd like to see us explore the next meeting that continue helping us mine information on where we are currently, and to help us focus, you know, specifically on our housing and custody aspects that help give the overall committee what they need. What would those recommendations be?
I think we've already covered them. Number one, a clear delineation of the population in that breakdown, so we can see that in a matrix form for all of us to take a look at. And then maybe, Chief O'Neill, you might want to then think about projections based upon that. What I touched base on before, which I think we need to speak to as well, is all those surrounding services, the kitchen, storage, utilities, parking, administrative offices for those who manage the detention center. What are those requirements? Presently, how many officers, are there locker rooms there? I mean, are there spaces for them and as part of that process? We focus strictly today on the population, but we also need to take a look at what other things are hosted in there. In addition to which, and maybe this is me speaking ignorantly, but are there, do we house programs in there? I understand DCPS school, for example, is in there. So what other than beds and cells, do we need in a facility that addresses custody and housing?
Okay, good. And then I'm sure in some of the comments you made as far as the kitchen HVAC, other things like that, my guess is Councilman White will be exploring some of those things as well.
Well, he's absolutely doing that right now as it relates to the existing facility. So what repairs need to be done to the facility to make it workable for the foreseeable future. I hate to say how long, but at least for the foreseeable future. But that really is not your concern. Your concern, what is it today, but what do we anticipate we need going forward in a new facility, however form
okay.
I mean, it's going to vary. You're right. If we end up with a number of buildings on a campus-like environment, the kitchen could be an isolated facility that requires transporting back and forth. As opposed to having seven kitchens, you would have one kitchen serving seven buildings, however that plays out. So, but I think that's what you want to note to your initial question, what do we have today, and how well does it meet our needs, and how will it meet our needs in the future?
Okay, very good. Thank you for that input, Chair.
Yeah, that is some of the stuff that was in the models that we have. So we will continue to, you know, push forward with
that's,
that.
That's great. And then if we need anyone else, if there is someone else, you know, at JSO or anyone else you know of that's very well versed in these areas that Chair Boylan just spoke of, or any other related areas, you know, that go into the details of the programs and helping us make that assessment. You know, I don't want to put this all on you. So if there's someone else you would like to bring with you next time or someone we should reach out to invite, please let us know. Be happy to do that.
I'll do it.
Okay. Are there any other comments from anyone? Any questions? Okay. Oh, yes, we have one more.
Yeah, Mr. Miller, I'm new to this, and perhaps you've related this to Carson, but I would like to understand the basic objective of this group from the standpoint of, are we trying to decide from the information here in these first two meetings to build a new building? Are we trying to decide also, is there potential to use the existing facility? Or is that a foregone conclusion that that is not a part of the equation? Just generally speaking, what's the ultimate goal of deciding here?
Well, I mean, we are one working group of five, and so that's where, you know, and the chair was helping me a little bit on the focus here, but that's where our group is supposed to be exclusively focused on the housing custody part of assessing where we currently are and then going forward with recommendations on facility-wise, what type of facility do we really need?
Okay.
We know what we have, and we're mining all of the details of that and those challenges, but ideally, if we were moving forward with what we know and our current situation and our projections that was just mentioned, moving forward, then what would that series of structures or what would those facilities look like and how would they be structured and, you know, what would we need to be able to make that all happen? And I'm... You know, I may be stepping out here, but I'm assuming, you know, part of that process will be we will find the appropriate place and land, you know, to be able to support what our collective committee and working groups come up with on what that looks like. And this may be 5 or so years down the road, but we certainly want to help in the short run, short term, and not only assessing where we are, but also what are adjustments that can be made to help short term. But then, you know, 3 to 5 years from now, ideally, what does that look like to make this situation much, much better for all involved? Is that fair,
Chair? That's
fair,
and I think it's fair to say too, the model for each of the working group isn't going to be that much different. So meetings 1 and 2, as Council Member Miller correctly said, is what's our existing and what are we looking for in the future? To hand off to entities like yourself and HDR and Gil Bain and say, okay, this is what we've determined our needs are. What kind of facilities have you built that are comparable to this so that we can take a look at some of the existing, I characterize them as best practices. So what have you built lately that kind of speaks to our concerns as it relates to, in this case, custody and housing? And then you can speak to that. And so that's what, assuming meetings 3 and 4 will help them get a sense as to what's being built presently, Atlanta, you know, Miami, right. Others. You know, I know Tampa recently, not too distant, and did this kind of facilities. So that's really the ideal scenario for us, is to see what we need, what you and others can bring to the table with respect to ideas as to how you address these needs, right. And then go from there.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. And with that, thank you all for coming and look forward to seeing any of you or anyone you think may have an interest and may want to provide constructive input into the process. We certainly welcome that. So just as a reminder, the next meeting of this working group, the Housing and Custody Working Group, will be Friday, October 13th at 8 a.m. in this room. Thank you very much. Have a great weekend. Thank you, Chair. I appreciate it. No, it was very helpful.
Yeah.
It was very helpful because we want to make sure you see all of
the picture. That's what I'm trying to do.